This is Just Asking Questions, a show for inquiring minds on reason.
How likely is a Kamala Harris presidency? Just Asking Questions. I'm Zach Weissmuller, senior producer for Reason, joined by my co-host, Liz Wolf, Reason Associate Editor and author of the daily Reason Roundup. Hey, Liz.
Hey, Zach.
We're joined today by Nate Silver, statistician and author of the new book, On the Edge, The Art of Risking Everything, which comes out next week, but you can pre-order it now. He founded the renowned polling aggregator and politics website 538 and now does his own version of all that work at his Substack, Silver Bulletin. Nate, thank you for joining us today.
How are you guys?
We're great.
Yeah.
So the latest forecast on your website, this is as of our August 8th broadcast. Let me pull that up. It has Kamala Harris with an edge in the national polls, 45.8% to 43.7%. And probably even more importantly, with an edge in key swing states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Nevada, and Michigan. And that would give her a predicted electoral college win. Let's go to one more slide here. Nate's, what do you think are the main keys to explaining this snapshot?
I mean, I think it is important to emphasize that to a first approximation, it's 50-50. I mean, more literally, it's like 52-48 in our forecast. She has put Democrats in a much better position than they have with Joe Biden. I mean, Joe Biden was, the poker term we use is drawing dead, when no matter what happens, it's going to wind up badly for you. Wasn't quite there, but almost drawing dead. Whereas Harris is 50-50, maybe 50-50 plus a little bit. You know, she has about a 2-point edge in national polls, like the slide you showed. There is an electoral college disadvantage for Democrats. Typically, we saw that in 2016, for example. But if you look at polls of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, she's actually, you know, a point or so ahead on average in those states. She's brought states like Nevada, Georgia, Arizona much closer than Biden was, in part because she is resonating more with younger voters who are plentiful in those states. Georgia, lots of young professionals, lots of Black voters who she's also doing better with than Biden was. So it's a real barn burner of a race. We may look back and say this was kind of a high watermark for Harris, but so far the momentum has been in her favor.
Do you feel just like incredibly vindicated? Because you were one of the more prominent voices who was kind of raising a ruckus early and frankly quite often that Biden simply was an untenable candidate, that this was a Weekend at Bernie's-esque scenario and that he just had to be, I don't want to say like taken care of, but he couldn't win the election. Do you feel like this is going to be one of those things that's just memory hold? Like, how much do you care?
I'm a competitive guy, so I care a little bit. Part of me...
Not that it's like all about you, right? Like this presidential race is not all about Nate Silver, but also it a little bit is, right?
Some degenerate part of me wanted to run the science experiment of seeing how badly Biden's poll numbers would go when he was not really capable of running a normal campaign. but no, look, Democrats didn't have a competitive primary. We can talk about that if you want. There is a lot of consensus behind Kamala Harris in the party right now. I think that helps her a fair bit. But yeah, I mean, the vibes, I'm not a big vibes guy, but the vibes of trying to have this Weekend of Bernie's moment for a whole year really wasn't working for Democrats. And if you looked at polls of Senate races and other races, Democrats were doing fine there. They're actually a pretty effective party at winning elections, but they were kind of... they're kind of lying to people about Biden's fitness for another 4 years in office. No one really believed that, you know, he should have the job until he's 86. And so magically, I mean, look, Harris has been a stronger candidate than I thought. But literally, I'd rather would have Bernie Sanders than Joe Biden from an electoral standpoint, just because he was able to like actually still be a capable politician and Joe Biden hadn't been.
I wouldn't say they were kind of lying, right? Like they were like quite aggressively.
They're calling, you know, videos of Biden looking like he's 81 years old, like cheap fakes and things like that. Yeah. And the fact is he's 81 years old, probably doing pretty well for an 81-year-old. But yeah, I mean, you have to touch grass at some point, right? You can spin the media to some extent, but you can't spin your way out of the fact that Biden couldn't complete a sentence in the debate. And so they wised up and made a very, I think, competent choice to replace him.
So the big political news of earlier this week has quite obviously been the selection of Tim Walz as Kamala's running mate. You've written a little bit about how he's a Minnesota nice pick.
Yeah.
And one thing that I'm really curious about is how much does this selection, what does this symbolize about, like, what is Harris trying to telegraph to us? How much does this pick actually matter? And also, are Minnesotans like good at national politics?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Hubert H. Humphrey and Walter Mondale would suggest perhaps they aren't. You know, Amy Klobuchar is amazingly popular in Minnesota, didn't quite translate on the national stage as much. Look, I think it's a perfectly competent and sane pick. I would have personally picked Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania. I think the research shows that that moderation helps you win. And Pennsylvania is a very diverse state that has rural areas and urban areas and suburban areas and black voters and white voters. And it's almost in the south part of the Appalachian area. But look, it's a, you know, I think Kamala Harris is kind of betting on a theory that they can ride momentum to the election. And the vibes have been good so far. And like, usually I would think that was BS because the election is a very, very long occasion and you kind of pay a price sometimes. If you have a good moment, then the momentum turns on you. However, we're in like a sprint and not a marathon. We have the Democratic convention starting in a week and a half, and it's going to feel from that point onward like this thing is happening really fast. And so, you know, look, I don't think it's the right choice, but it's within the margin of error of a good choice. And it's not a bad pick, I don't think.
Could you expand on this Minnesota nice concept a little bit? You wrote a whole post about it, and I think it's helpful in understanding why they made this pick as opposed to Shapiro, although it certainly doesn't explain the whole story. Before I have you explain what Minnesota nice is, though, I want to play a clip from one of Walz's recent speeches where he's making a sort of sly joke about J.D. Vance and ask, how nice is that? Play that, John.
Like all regular people I grew up with in the heartland, J.D. studied at Yale, had his career funded by Silicon Valley billionaires, and then wrote a bestseller trashing that community. Come on! That's not what middle America is. And I gotta tell you, I can't wait to debate the guy. That is if he's willing to get off the couch and show up. So, you see what I did there?
Okay, so he's, for anyone who has been asleep or is, you know, out there
Zach
touching
like,
grass.
How do I explain the couch fucking joke on a live stream?
Yeah.
Yes, there's a fake story about J.D. Vance in his, the story is that in his memoir on some page, he writes about having sex with the sofa. The person who made this up was very clear from the beginning that it's a fake story, but now it is a meme that's been circulating about J.D. Vance and now picked up by the Democrats' vice presidential candidate.
It's also like a little bit believable because Hillbilly Elegy is a coming of age memoir and like teenage boys have done strange things before. Totally fabric, like totally completely made up, and yet it's taken on a life of its own, right? So is he actually Minnesota nice?
I would not. Minnesota nice is passive aggression, right? It's like,
yeah,
okay,
so this fits
can
in
I
the
stay over tonight? Can I want to drive up? Can I stay over? Oh, of course. Oh, sure. Make yourself at home, right? When you hate the person's guts. That's that's more like dad, sitcom dad humor that is very memeified, I guess. And like, I mean, but this is kind of part of the asymmetry, right? Like the J.D. Vance couch fucking joke is misinformation. And, you know, I'm not sure how many people take it that seriously, but the fact is like Democrats can kind of sometimes get away with that because like the press is not as deathly serious about that as they are with things involving Trump. And like, and so I think like, I think Harris, I was going to say Harris and Vance, Harris and Walz are kind of much smarter about navigating the media environment. What can you get away with as a Democrat and what can't you, right? You can't get away with like saying that someone who's 81 years old should be president for another 4 years. You maybe can't get away with saying, wink, wink, it's a joke about J.D. Vance. And like Liz said, you know, there's something that resonates about it a little bit. I mean, J.D. Vance is I guess, kind of a unconventional VP pick. Maybe you'd say he's weird, I suppose. But they've run a much smarter campaign. I think getting rid of like all the Biden dead enders, the people who thought it was a good idea to have this guy run for president until his mid-80s, helps a bit. Although from what I hear, there's actually a lot of overlap between the Harris campaign staffers and the Biden campaign, and they just have much better raw material to work with.
Yeah, the whole setting J.D. Vance up as he's this weird guy and I'm kind of the normal Midwestern dad. How effective do you think that's likely to be?
I mean, all we know right now is that Harris has moved up in the polls and she became the candidate. Yeah. You know, again, like I said, usually momentum peters out at some point. Things seem to have been steadying a little bit. But I defer. I'm not a political tactician, right? I'm a big picture, zoom out strategy guy. Big picture, they've drawn a race that Trump was winning into a tie, or maybe a tie with a slight Democratic lean. And so I'm not one to like critique strategy too much when the top line results have been effective.
I wanted to ask, you know, Kamala Harris has been, I think, sort of struggling to get her footing policy wise. There's been a little bit of a dearth of actual policy substance in terms of what we've seen put out by her campaign, which partially makes sense because all of this happened in a haphazard fashion. And perhaps part of their strategy is also trying to really capitalize on the vibe shifting and, you know, all these things, as opposed to actually making it a very policy-centric campaign. But what do you think Harris's biggest political liabilities will be for the next few months?
I mean, the fact is that she ran pretty far to the left in 2019. And in fact, didn't even make it to 2020. She dropped out well before Iowa. You know, that's a big liability. She does not have a great electoral track record. I mean, she only barely won her attorney general's race in California in 2010. It's hard to only barely win as a Democrat in California. Her campaign in 2019, 2020 was a flop. But she seems to, I don't know, you know how, are you guys basketball fans, right? You know how like Kobe Bryant went to like Germany and got some mysterious injection in his knee? I feel like Kamala Harris went to Germany and like suddenly became like a pretty good candidate, right? Something, I mean, she had like a moment. Yesterday there was some Gaza protester and she kind of stared him down for a minute and was very composed in the moment. And, you know, I guess like having 4 years of experience giving a lot of speeches as vice president and kind of being free to the burdens, I'm almost quoting her now, free of the burdens of this kind of like peak wokeness period in 2019, 2020, and like a White House. I mean, I think the Biden White House didn't want Harris to be a star because they were worried that people would say, hey, why are you not handing the vice presidency or the presidency over to your vice president when you're 81 years old? So free of the burdens of that, she is proving to be, I think, a decent candidate.
Well, so whatever the burdens that the Democratic Party carries and is now unburdened by in the context of where we are now, one of those burdens has been dealing with the left wing of the party on issue. One of the salient issues in Michigan where she just appeared is the war in Gaza. And there was just this clip that came out today of her shutting down a protester at her rally for making some noise about the situation in Gaza. I want to play that clip and get your reflections on how much that whole battle matters right now.
He intends to surrender our fight against the climate crisis. And he intends to end the Affordable Care Act. You know what? If you want Donald Trump to win, then say that. Otherwise, I'm speaking.
Darn luck.
I'm here because we believe in democracy. Everyone's voice matters, but I am speaking now.
I am speaking now.
Okay, is this going to be a problem for the Harris-Walz campaign, or is this kind of a sideshow that doesn't matter?
I think it's closer to being overrated. Look, I am not trying to take any stance on the Israel-Gaza conflict.
Right.
I do think it's a conversation that elites, I guess we're all elites here in some respect, right? We all, you know, professionally talk about politics, and we probably have other friends and associates who do too. And that group of people care a lot for understandable reasons about the war in Gaza. If you look at polling of the broader electorate, it's a pretty small issue for most people. Maybe 0.5% of the electorate, I've actually tried to quantify this, are people on the left who think Democrats are too centrist or too pro-Israel. Maybe 0.2 or 0.3% of the electorate are, you know, are people who think they're too accommodating to Palestine, but 99% of people don't treat it as a voting issue. In Michigan, where you have a big Palestinian Arab American population, and you also have, of course, a couple of huge universities. I'm from Michigan. Grew up in East Lansing, Michigan, Michigan State University. It might be more relevant. That might be why Michigan has trended more toward being a swing state like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. It's usually a little bit more blue leaning. But look, I think you generally speaking, you win in elections by moderating. People don't like that conclusion. You know, I have my own political views, but generally speaking, goes back to like the median voter theorem, that if you can appear that you're representing the center of the country and say what you want about like the weird attacks, but at the very least they're saying, hey, we're the normal party, right? They're weird. And of course Democrats are weird too, but at least that shows some instinct for moderation.
But hold on. I just want to linger on that for a second. Like, we've just spent the past few years operating in sort of like the trenches of crazy wokeness, like the excesses of wokeness, right? Yeah. Like, I think all of us are sort of like probably Obama era, like, I don't know, man, a little bit more diversity sure is nice type thing. Yeah. Like, some more representation in film sure is good. But then like a whole bunch of like crazy wokester progressives really took it and ran. And so how much will this applause line that Walz is now attempting to use, this idea of like trying to draw this bright line between like, you know, we really understand the normal people, but like, those Republicans over there, they're really weird. Like, is this actually, this feels like the type of thing that would have worked 10 years ago. And now it feels hollow or like a stretch, like, political memory is just really, really short.
I think they are really, and look, Democrats are pretty weird and progressives are pretty weird as conservatives are. I mean, look, I think usually the VPs don't matter. I do think the J.D. Vance thing is a little bit of a factor here, right? He's kind of unknown and can be branded in a certain way. And again, it's a short campaign, so you don't necessarily have to reach the long run of this argument. And the press is not very sympathetic to Trump or to Vance. No, look, I agree. I think it's like inherently dangerous for anyone who's a political junkie to call anybody else weird, because intrinsically it's a pretty fucking weird hobby to like be this into politics.
None of us are normal people, right? Like anybody who's sitting in a governor's mansion, literally anywhere, is just like distinctly odd.
No, but look, I think the attack is actually like a little bit novel. And one of the things that's remarkable to me about the Trump campaign is that they didn't seem to believe that Biden would drop out, right? That they thought that Democrats were a personality cult, and they can be, you know, around Obama or Bill Clinton, they can be a personality cult, or JFK going way back, right? But Biden was basically the candidate that was appointed by the party. I mean, Obama picked him as VP in 2008 because he thought Biden wouldn't succeed him. And then improbably, Biden wanted to run himself, and kind of you had everyone come together and help him win the nomination in 2020. So he was a creature of the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party quite rationally concluded that a different candidate would have a better chance of winning and ushered him out. I mean, you know, if it had come down to a fight at the convention, I'm not sure what would have happened. But they used every leverage that they could to make that choice. And they were not, they are more capable than Trump of like replacing a flawed candidate.
So how, you know, one of the weird things about the Democratic Party at this moment to me is just the nature of how this all went down. I mean, you experienced the brunt of being somebody who was just noticing that Biden is old and doesn't seem like he's up for another 4 years of this. And then like hellfire came down. And then suddenly it was okay to talk about it after this debate. And then Biden kind of gets sick and goes silent for several days and then releases this letter. Like, that is all weird. Like, these circumstances are very weird. There's critics say there's an undemocratic nature to all of this because of the way there was no open primary. There was, you know, no open convention. Kamala just kind of slotted in there. How big of a problem is that sort of weirdness and perceived undemocraticness for the party?
I mean, I think there is a story about, you know, is Biden fit to be president right now? I mean, he seems to have some type of syndrome of something. Credible people have speculated it might be something adjacent to Parkinson's, if not Parkinson's itself. And like, if there is a 3 a.m. phone call from North Korea or something, or a conflict in Taiwan or Russia or whatever else, right? Then, you know, is he operating at high enough capacity for enough of the 24/7 news day? I mean, you know, it's kind of funny that the press kind of stopped worrying about Biden. The minute Harris replaced, they were treating it as like a horse race story and not a governance story. With that said, it doesn't seem like he's clinging to her too much. It seems like a lot of the problem was that he was being stubborn. Like, his actual approval ratings have gone up now that he's agreed not to run for a second term. And so, you know, look, Democrats have lots of problems, right? They have inflation, which is still a, you know, not so distant lingering memory for people. They've been too far to the left on some issues. But, you know, age was the elephant in the room, and maybe Biden standing down solves half their problems, not all their problems. And remember, like Trump is a flawed candidate too. He's lost the popular vote twice. He is also quite old. He had the opportunity, I think, to kind of like seize the center after the assassination attempt. Instead, he picks J.D. Vance, actually overriding his initial instincts based on advice from his sons. At the convention, he gives a very moving speech for the first half hour and then goes on another hour with like lots and lots of grievances, is getting into a fight with the Republican governor of Georgia, which is one of the most critical swing states. So Trump is, this was Trump's campaign to lose. And now he's not lost it yet. It's 50-50, but he's no longer in an advantageous position based partly on mistakes that he's made.
Yeah, but I have a slightly different question, which is really about the Democrats partially want to make this an election about saving democracy.
Yeah.
And it's perceived as by some as a very undemocratic process that has led to Kamala Harris being the nominee on the ticket. I was looking at this recent Harvard Caps poll on that question, and this was from July. This is asking if voters, should there have been a more competition to nominate a replacement to Biden, or was it important to show unity and coalesce behind Vice President Harris? Overall, 57% say there should have been more competition. When you look at the party affiliation, that's only 27% of Democrats. So 73% of Democrats say they're fine with Kamala being the nominee. 85% of the GOP says it's undemocratic. That's a little bit of concern trolling. And then the independents that's the more concerning part. 60% say there should have been more competition. So I guess that's the question that I feel like is still sort of floating over the Democrats right now, just because of the strange nature of what has gone down.
I mean, look, I thought what was undemocratic is like not having a real primary in the first place, right? Where Biden refused to have debates. They ushered, I mean, look, the candidates who opposed him, like, no offense to Marianne Williams or Dean Phillips, but they're not really a fully fledged alternative to Biden. I mean, Phillips might have been if he'd entered earlier, but he was like kind of blackballed by the liberal media, right? He couldn't get on MSNBC, for example, because they didn't want a competitive primary. Biden didn't have any debates. They moved the schedule around to put stronger Biden states like South Carolina first. So, look, once you were in this emergency situation, I mean, look, I read a column in the New York Times saying, yeah, actually, we should have like a quasi-primary. I think the fact is, though, that Harris would have won that primary. I mean, she was clearly working behind the scenes to consolidate support from Democrats. Like 88% of Democrats now say that they're the nominee that she would that they would choose. And so I you know, she showed something in that interim period and played her cards pretty well. And yeah, I mean, I think Biden was stubborn and selfish, and that if you had had a Democratic primary a year ago, then Harris might have won anyway, right? But that would have been better for the process. But like, I don't think there was anything, you know, the fact that people, by the way, Marianne Williamson and Dean Phillips like withdrew after a few states, right? The fact that, you know, some voters in Minnesota or something didn't vote for Marianne Williamson instead of Joe Biden, I don't think gives him any particular legitimacy. And at least Harris was his running mate, right? She was actually elected along with Biden in 2020. So there's at least a little flare of legitimacy somehow, I think.
What is the best case for Kamala Harris being a suitable candidate to win those crucial swing states? I mean, as far as I can tell, she's a California Democrat, which means she's really only operated and been able to make the case for herself on really fertile ground that seems kind of primed to already be interested. So how will she win Pennsylvania?
No, and her marches have not been great. I mean, look, again, I go back to the fact that, you know, Trump is a deeply flawed candidate, and Trump is pretty far to the right. He's kind of old news in a lot of ways. There are things like January 6th. There are things like his criminal conviction and the various trials against him. And again, he's been unpopular for most of the past 12 years that he's been in the public spotlight. And so she's kind of trying a little bit to like run out the clock and saying, yeah, I'm a little bit of a shapeshifter. I'm a little bit amorphous, but like, maybe that's okay. Look, in a representative democracy, I don't care if you're a shapeshifter, right? You're supposed to represent me. And so I don't care if you have some deeply ideological view, right? I don't want a politician who's like a public intellectual necessarily. So yeah, it's a bet on the fact that like, she looks more like the kind of emerging America, and that she can kind of like meme her way and duck and dodge her way into presenting herself as kind of the normal centrist alternative. Maybe Walz and Vance matter a little bit for that. And Democrats have like a good data operation, a good turnout operation. They're raising lots and lots and lots of money. I think that tends to be like a little bit overrated, but like Democrats know how to win elections. They had a very good midterm in 2018, a very good midterm in 2022. They did actually win 2020, although closer than the polls showed. So it's kind of just a bet that, hey, if you kind of run a generic Democrat against a generic Republican, or against a Trump, not against, but against Trump, right? Because all these Trumpy Republicans lost in 2022, right? The Mehmet Oz and the Herschel Walker and the Blake Masters, they all lost. And so, you know, it may just be the math as such that Democrats get 53% of the vote versus 47% for the GOP. And that's just enough, despite the Electoral College disadvantage that Harris will probably face.
Yeah, it feels like Vance is an ideological pick on Trump's part, but also a little bit it's Trump leaning into the mean-spiritedness that he does so well. Whereas Kamala picking Walz is an ideological pick all the same, but it seems like she's kind of attempting to lean into this folksiness, this sort of like wine on likability type thing, the youthfulness. And I'm curious about how this contrast, this juxtaposition that is being drawn rather deliberately, like both of them are basically saying, you know, we're going to eschew any sort of pragmatism as to like picking a Josh Shapiro type swing state VP. We're not going to be focused on that. And instead we're going to go with these people where they're just like, we're battening down the ideological hatches. And yet there's a very significant tonal difference that I wonder whether that'll make a massive difference in the long run.
I mean, I kind of halfway buy that, Liz, but halfway don't, in the sense that as a congressman from kind of rural southwestern Minnesota, Walz was pretty moderate, right? And then obviously as a governor of Minnesota, he's been quite progressive, but it's more like he's kind of amorphous and not fully formed. And I think they can mold that in different ways. Again, there's like better raw material to work with.
The other caveat that I think people make with Walz is like, there was a backlog of basically Democratic energy attempting to like push a whole bunch of bills. And for a while he was working with, you know, split legislature, and then Democrats got the majority. And so that sort of accounts for some of the massive flurry of legislative activity there.
And again, you know, the backlog idea, the bottled up energy comes up in a different context too, which is in 2016, younger Democrats wanted Bernie Sanders to win, and he wasn't nominated, right? In 2020, same thing, Bernie or Warren or somebody or Buttigieg, and instead it was Biden, right? In 2024, not even a competitive primary. So all of a sudden now you have pent up energy around a presidential candidate that you haven't had since 2012, right? And that can be overrated for sure. I mean, again, Harris is rising. That doesn't mean she'll continue to rise. It's a 50-50 election, more or less. But it makes sense in retrospect that you have a lot of pent up potential energy that's now being released for Democrats.
There's, you had a blog post that talks about the long shadow, the long political, long strange political shadow of 2020. And that's a shadow that is certainly cast over. It's certainly cast over my way of looking at politics. That is what I think about when I look at Kamala Harris and Walz, because Walz, you know, you mentioned he's more moderate in the Congress. He's more progressive as a governor, but he was governor of Minnesota during this COVID era. And during that era, he oversaw an out-migration. I've got some slides here to show. This highlighted down here is out-migration from Minnesota during his, since 2019 when he took office. There's some more figures from Minnesota state government showing domestic out-migration. That's kind of how I judge, like, are these people going to be responsible executives? We've got Walz from Minnesota, Kamala Harris from California, which I fled. Am I an outlier here? How significant is that long, strange shadow of the COVID era?
Look, I'm an elections guy, not a policy guy. I don't have a good prediction for you of how a Harris-Walz administration would govern necessarily. Walz said something yesterday about free speech, and he claimed that misinformation and hate speech are not protected categories, which they are, according to almost all constitutional scholars. I think they might be in practice quite progressive. But politically, though, somehow people don't seem to associate Harris with this difficult time that we had in 2020, right? People kind of misremember. They have a memory hole thing where they almost assume that Biden was president in 2020 when it was Trump. But just kind of breaking with that period. I mean, one thing I think people underrate is just how traumatic the pandemic was for nearly everybody, right? People dying, people getting sick, normal life disrupted if you're in a blue state or even a purple state for the most part. Just having more distance from that and turning the page, I think, is probably smart. Incumbent parties all around the world that have been in power were losing elections in the UK and so forth. Modi won, but lost a lot of his majority in India, for example. Just having a break from this really shitty period in American life. And yes, she was the vice president, but she wasn't the president. She is still a fresher face. Just having a break from the super fucking annoying past, I think, is a smart strategy.
Does that account for why? I think I had an expectation, and this might be because I am not a pollster or somebody who, who's especially adept at analyzing such things. But I sort of expected, coming out of the pandemic, maybe circa 2020, a sense that the things that were done to us, and maybe this is especially colored by being a New Yorker, but an idea that the things that were done to us were just profoundly unacceptable, right? The masking of children, the incredible, amount of debt that many businesses had to go into because they simply were not, restaurants were not allowed to be open. The forced vaccinations, technically not forced, but forced if you wanted to participate in public life in any way or, continue to stay employed, which are two things that most people tend to want to do. And I had for whatever reason, and then also the school closures. I'm a parent, Zach is too. This really, really matters to parents. I had expected this type of thing to matter more in a more enduring way for people to have longer memories about this. And yes, okay, the Youngkin thing in Virginia. Okay, sure. We can chalk some specific electoral outcomes to this, but I kind of expected it to be a bigger deal. Do you, as somebody who has way more expertise in this, have any idea or any theories as to am I incorrect in saying, wow, I really thought this would be a bigger thing that would be reflected in people's voting later on?
Look, I think there are some long-term consequences in terms of continued decline in trust for establishment-type institutions like the media and universities and things like that, and the government in general. But people, I mean, people are used to an environment where the political news cycle changes quickly, right? Glenn Youngkin
almost got assassinated, and we literally
and we almost forget about
so quickly, right? Like,
yeah, Glenn and Ron DeSantis in 2022 won re-election by landslide margins, partly based on COVID stuff, right? I was a frequent visitor to Florida myself during that period. But by 2023, 2024, it was kind of old news. And I think there's something about COVID where like people don't want to talk about it because it was a very bad memory, right? Maybe it's repressed and affects things in all types of intangible, bottled up ways. But I think the news cycle has moved on.
You also, you know, the old political maxim is that it's the economy, stupid. You know, and you have your own version of an economic index to look at. And the most pertinent item there is that first item, real disposable personal income, which you have at down, you know, negative 0.68 now, projected down negative 0.75 in November. This is from your 538 days. You kind of tracked how this particular economic indicator tracks with presidential elections. Could you just explain that a little bit further? Like, why is this such an important indicator? Is the economy still central? And like, what can we, like, how does that factor into what we might expect in 2024?
So this is literally how much money do you have in real terms, meaning adjusted for inflation, in your take home? How much is coming into your bank account every month? And that number has struggled to keep up with inflation over the Biden-Harris presidency. You know, in contrast, you've had very high corporate profits. I mean, this is a Reason podcast. People probably think that's okay. The stock market until recently has done fairly well under Biden's watch. But real take-home pay has struggled, particularly in the first 2 years of his term. And so, look, what our index says is that the economy is about average, right? You have Biden focusing on the jobs numbers that are very good, ignoring the inflation numbers that are now okay-ish, but were very, very bad for the first, you know, year and a half, 2 years of his term. When you average it all out, then there are positive and negative indicators, which would point toward a close election. Usually, if the economy is good, the incumbent wins. The economy is bad, the incumbent loses. Here you have a mixed story, so it might actually come down to the, you know, proverbial 5,000 votes in Georgia, Wisconsin, et cetera.
Yeah. I've been watching Kamala Harris's speeches in the past few days, and there's not a lot of policy, especially economic policy, but there is one line in there that she keeps repeating about, it's like she has to acknowledge that inflation has hurt people, but also, you know, emphasize that the economy is really not that bad. Like, we've done a good job patching it up. I'd like to just play that segment of her speech from Wisconsin yesterday to just talk a little bit about like what is the Harris Walls message on the economy. John, could you roll that clip?
We believe in a future where we lower the cost of living for America's families so that they have a chance not just to get by, but to get ahead. Because while our economy is doing well by many measures, prices for everyday things like groceries are still too high. You know it and I know it. You know, when I was Attorney General, I went after price fixing schemes. And when I am president, it will be a day one priority to fight to bring down prices. I will take on big corporations that engage in illegal price gouging. I will take on corporate landlords that unfairly raise rents on working families. I will take on big pharma and cap the cost of prescription drugs for all Americans. Continue to bring manufacturing jobs back to America.
Okay, so let me first acknowledge as a libertarian, that all sounds like a complete nightmare. We're talking about price controls.
Like
we're
talking about
maybe rent. I'm a University of Chicago educated economics major, so I'm inclined to agree.
What's your reaction as a Chicago boy to that?
No, part of the reaction is just that, like, to have a Democrat who is not Joe Biden and capable of making just a good political, which is a political argument, right? Like, these levers don't actually do very much to solve inflation. It might make the economy worse in some ways, but she is able to have a little bit more distance from the past 4 years to say, yeah, inflation's a problem, and it's not quite implied that it's her problem. I mean, right. If the Trump campaign were smarter, and they will wise up, I'm sure they will tie her to these issues these past 4 years and not let her distance herself as much, right? But she has some dexterity as a politician. If you go back to that debate where, like, you know, Trump was saying lots of untrue things. I'm not like a pearl clutching like fact checker, but like Biden wasn't capable of like pointing out obvious BS, and she's capable of, I don't know, she's a normal political athlete when Democrats didn't have one before, and that might be enough to win against Trump.
Yeah, we're whatever the whoever wins this, we do seem destined for a protectionist hell escape coming forward, because they're both talking about, like, we need to protect American manufacturing. So, in Trump's world, that seems to mean a 10% tariff across the board, 60% on China.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I don't know exactly what the agenda is here for the Democrats, but both seem eager to do a lot of protectionist measures that, if you're talking about trying to fight inflation, which we all agree was pretty painful over these past years, this is not a promising strategy.
No, protectionism is on the rise. Anti-immigration sentiment is on the rise. So I'm not sure if it's a great election for libertarian-minded people either way, necessarily.
Yeah, I think I'm going to spend Election Day surfing and not voting. don't tell anyone. I want to transition to talking about your new book, On the Edge. I want you to explain to our viewers, what exactly is this book about? And I also, in that description, I would really, really like it if you could explain the concept of the river.
So the book is about a world that I kind of inhabit, which I call the river. Which is the world of people that take risk for a living, but more kind of like a personality archetype, right? It's people who are extremely competitive, crossed with being really analytical. You might think of like an analytical person, oh, they're going to be like careful with the numbers, they're an accountant or an actuary. No, these are people who like to gamble figuratively or literally. They're mostly big nerds who talk about like Bayes' theorem and expected value and things like that. But they're my people. The first trip I took by plane after the pandemic was I flew to like a casino, the Hard Rock Seminole Casino in Hollywood, Florida. And it was an amazing, wonderful shit show, right? After being cooped up for a year, you had record numbers playing in a poker tournament, mask requirements may or may not have been enforced rigorously.
Were they smoking inside or no?
Oh, of course. It's a casino in Florida, Liz. Of course they're smoking. In fact, people were deliberately smoking in order to like avoid the mask requirement, right? You have to wear a mask if you're not eating, drinking, or smoking something. So therefore, all of your incentive, I guess.
Perfect loophole.
Yeah. Not a very well thought out policy. But they had record numbers for this poker tournament. I'm like, I'm among my people now. I've always played poker. I played poker in the poker boom years of the mid-2000s before I ever made an election model. But these people are also very powerful and very wealthy, right? If you look at kind of the most, like literally the richest people on earth, all have this extreme risk-taking appetite. Elon Musk and Sam Altman, or with a less positive spin, I talked to Sam Bankman-Fried a lot in the book, and he is a sign about how these things can very much spin out of control and the kind of flaws in this ideology. But the river is at war, I would say, with what I call the village, right? Which is the establishment, which is media, government, academia, Washington, D.C., New York City, Boston. And you kind of see this playing out in different ways. Bill Ackman versus the university presidents, or the New York Times suing OpenAI over copyright infringement. Look, lots of people in the river, actually, it's a pretty, there are a fair share of libertarians there. It's pretty purple overall. You do see the right fringe of it, though. I mean, Elon Musk has been red-pilled, I think, and some other people there. But the conflict between academia and Silicon Valley is something I talk about a lot in the book, for example. Even though it's a book about gambling It's a long book. It's 3 years of my life. It's kind of a cross section of lots of things, and I hope people will enjoy the adventure.
Could you make the kind of like intellectual case for gambling? Because it's seen as this very degenerate, harmful thing that needs to be banned and regulated by states. I've heard you, or I've seen you make the case that there's, you know, there is some value here in terms of information seeking. Make that case for us if you could.
Yeah, I mean, look, because I am libertarian, lowercase l leaning, then I'm not somebody who wants to regulate people's ability to engage in behaviors that might be harmful, and that probably goes for gambling too. But like, I don't actually think gambling is necessarily societally beneficial, right? I mean, I think like, I think poker is good because it just kind of teaches people a lot of math skills and social skills, and it's just kind of a good game to train yourself on. I think kind of the higher end casino resorts where people go and have a nice vacation and gamble a little bit and have a nice experience, right? Like, you know, in Las Vegas now, less than half of revenues are from the actual gambling floor. But like slot machines are probably quite bad and prey on people who have no sense of probability and might be a little bit addicted, for example. Like the state lottery is the most predatory form of gambling at all. Actually, it's a very libertarian statement, right? But it takes a much higher margin than casino gambling does and has the lowest socioeconomic profile. So if I were a total utilitarian, then I'd say, yeah, you can have a casino where you have poker and then some table games like blackjack and you have a nice environment for people. But maybe you don't have slot machines and the lottery and horse racing and things like that.
Isn't this the most elitist possible take on gambling though? Like you're like a huge and prominent gambling defender and you're like, okay, but this type, the poker table, the social version is fine, but the slot machines are sort of like lowbrow, right? Like,
well, that's why I'd say like utilitarian, but I'm not a utilitarian, right? I'm more of a lowercase libertarian. So I'd say, okay, do whatever you want. But like, I do think that, slot machine gambling in particular and the lottery in particular are probably fairly harmful to people. And you probably want more friction, right? You want, you can do it, but there are slightly higher barriers to it. Like, I think a little bit like
when
you
have seen. I have seen a video of somebody sitting at a slot or at a slot machine, like pissing herself. So maybe like required bathroom breaks at the very least would be my compromise with the statists.
No, I mean, look, it's a little bit like you go to like Canada or Europe and see like those cigarette packs, you have like a collapsed lung or something on it. Like I'm not too bothered by that. Right. You are giving people the choice. So maybe you want, I don't know. But yeah. Look, I'm a fan of skilled gambling. So poker and sports betting are the two games where if you're good, you can in principle make a living. I'm kind of indifferent to, I mean, look, I find Las Vegas to be like a amazing and fun and fascinating place, right? Maybe you should have gambling only in Las Vegas. It's like a special temple mecca where the rules don't apply as much, right? I love the cross-section of America that you get at a casino resort. It's a fascinating microcosm for kind of capitalism in certain ways. I mean, Las Vegas is like the most American place on earth, I think.
Explain what you mean by that. Like what type of cross-section do you, like what do you love about the cross-section? Like you're walking through a Vegas casino and like, what are the different types of people that you're seeing?
Everybody, old people, young people, every possible race, people from different countries, people from all over the United States, men, women. I mean, they're different, you know, men are more table games, women are more slots and things like that. And Las Vegas is like a lot of immigrant population. There's like great food in Las Vegas. It's just unabashedly tacky. And I kind of appreciate that.
I like the idea of the casino floor and like all of these people hoping to make a quick buck or to make a buck via their skill, like either via luck or skill, believing in one or both of those. And I like the idea of like, that is a little bit of a, I think that's what people hate about libertarians. But I also think that it's something to kind of love about like, this sort of libertarian ethos that sort of like is at the heart of a lot of American culture, right? Like there's this idea of like, people are very motivated by that type of thing. We can't really, get ourselves free of that hope.
No, America has always been like a risk-taking country. It's kind of a book in some weird ways about what makes America different and exceptional. I mean, you know, going to war with the British, we were this much smaller army. That was a crazy risk that worked out pretty well, for example, the American Revolution. And you see now that like our economy is still growing in a way that the EU's isn't, although our life expectancy is stagnating in a way where the EU's is growing. So like we have chosen risk in some ways as a country. And say what you want about Silicon Valley. There's a lot about Silicon Valley in the book. And you can say both as an industry or as individuals, lots of flaws with Silicon Valley and that business model. But it does attract the top talent from all around the world. People move to California to pursue their dreams as they always have dating back to the days of the gold rush. And despite all the problems with California, despite the high taxes and despite the whatever policies, overly progressive shutdowns during the pandemic, it's such a good idea, this idea of like taking risk and being able to build a business, right? It's such a good idea that it outweighs all the stupid shit that people have to contend with.
You've theorized a lot about the risk-taking gene. Aside from genetic predisposition, how do we foster more risk-taking in people? Have we become too societally risk-averse? And are the rules sort of inherently made by people who are rule-abiding as opposed to those of us who are more risk-interested, risk-taking?
Yeah, I think the community I call the village has become quite risk-averse. I mean, you saw this a lot during COVID policy, or with something which I know is important to Reason listeners, or like free speech, right? Like free speech actually does have consequences, right? It can rile people up. It can change minds. It can even incite reactions that are very strong sometimes. So, but you know, but if you believe that we have the right to free speech, or that in the long run, we take risk and some ideas are bad, some are good, and we'll kind of sort it out, like that's kind of a more risk-taking mindset. And you see the village has become, I think, more risk-averse in recent years. But if you are a risk taker, that kind of increases the premium on being willing to be contrarian and being willing to be different a little bit. I mean, look, obviously, some people take it too far. Sam Bankman-Fried had an insane, I mean, that literally, appetite for risk that was not very healthy, for example. You know, Elon Musk, if you read the Walter Isaacson book about Elon Musk, how he plays poker, he literally just goes all in every hand over and over and over again. That's like not optimal poker strategy, I have to advise you. But yeah, the average person in terms of their professional life, right, would be well advised to take on more risk. I mean, there've been experiments, for example, by Steve Levitt, is the economist at the University of Chicago who wrote Freakonomics, where he would have people flip coins to make major decisions, right? Like I'll flip a coin sometimes between like Thai food or tacos or something, right? But he had them like flip a coin about like, should I get divorced or should I quit my job or move across the country? And he found that when people flipped the coin, it came up heads and people actually made a change in their lives. They were happier on average. And I attribute this to the history of the fact that we have not lived in an abundant society for most of human evolution, right? We live in a world where if you go outside, you're under threat. You might be eaten by a tiger, or if you get sick, get some infection, there's no antibiotics, you die probably. Life expectancy is 38 years or something like that. And now we live in a comparative era of abundance. For some reason, some fraction of the population seems to be miserable about this instead of taking advantage of it. But like, it does call for like a somewhat more risk on taking advantage of your options mentality, I think, for most people. And you'll meet the exceptions in the book if you read the book.
How do we foster more risk taking in people aside from the genetic predisposition side? Like some people, one of the insights that you have in your book, and you go into a lot of detail about this, is that, you know, some people are just wired this way, right? Like,
yeah,
we can't necessarily explain that. But like, if say we were, say we were raising children and interested in how do we make it so that they are healthy risk takers and not operating from a place of fear, but rather sort of using their abundance for good things. Like how should people do that?
So I'm not a parent, and so I can't give advice on child rearing. I'd say the formula that seems to work well empirically is the, you know, tired and tried and true neoliberal formula, right? Which means that you have, on the one hand, you have strong property rights. So people keep at least some portion of what they generate, the wealth they generate. Of course, there's lots of taxes, but, and they also have their downside protected, right? There's a welfare state. So you have more than one bite at the apple. You don't have to worry about total ruin. And that combination, that kind of enlightenment era liberalism, has worked remarkably well. I mean, if you kind of look at the history of economic history, there is basically no growth at all for most of human history. And then we have the Enlightenment and we develop competent governments and property rights and the welfare state and liberalism. And all of a sudden things grow, and they've grown and grown and grown at 2 or 3% per year, which compounds a lot over time for since, like, you know, roughly 1776 when America was founded, ironically. And so, you know, maintaining that formula, I think, has been very useful, and it's lifted many people out of poverty globally. I don't think people, again, I know I have a sympathetic audience here. I don't think the average, like, media elite has spent enough time looking at economic history and understanding, you know, how much more poverty there was in China, India, Africa, all around the world 50 years ago, and how much, like, human welfare has improved, how much lifespans have been extended, how much rights have been expanded to more and more types of people. You know, the lack of belief in progress is, it's almost like misinformation that, like, people don't even realize how much better we have it than we had it generations ago.
How has that affected the way you've sort of designed your life and, like, your intellectual life specifically? Because you are somebody who was, I would say, very ensconced in the media establishment, but you have been willing to say uncomfortable things, to be the contrarian, to whether it's noticing that Biden is old or suggesting that maybe COVID could have leaked from a lab, things that have gotten pile-ons for you.
Yeah.
How does a risk assessment weigh into that project, into your larger intellectual project?
I mean, look, ironically, a lot of these positions are quite popular, right? If you right. survey people, they'll say, yeah, I think if I had to guess that COVID probably did come from a lab, or they'll say, yeah, I thought the lockdowns went too far, for example. And 85% of Americans thought that Biden was too old. So it's some combination of being willing to state the obvious and having been through enough iterations. It's not my first rodeo. And, like, I've learned that, you know, I don't know, I guess I'm kind of uncancelable, but, like, the censors don't have as much power as they would think, right? That for every person you kind of, every annoying whatever that you piss off on Twitter, if you get one newsletter subscriber for that, or have someone DM you and be, hey, you want to get a beer sometimes, because I kind of like what you're saying, even though I can't say it publicly, like, there's no consequence to these, like, annoying people being angry at you on Twitter. And if there is, then you need to, like, get better friends, right? As an adult, people should reach out to people more and make more friends, because, like, it just doesn't matter. And, like, being a little bit polarizing in a world of 8 billion people where you can find who you people are, who appreciate you, I mean, it's proven to be, like, you know, also the economics of it are, frankly, better, right? And so, I mean, ABC News, where I worked at 538, and before that ESPN, are the most mainstream middle brow brands in the world. You know, the average ABC News consumer is 68 years old or something like that. So just being willing to find your audience, the small to medium sized audience, but find your people, is it's just a lot more effective. Because this whole notion about, like, you know, gambling and probability models and Bayes theorem, these are not, like, topics for everybody, right? I mean, they kind of are on the highbrow intellectual side, and just owning that and embracing that and doing, like, a little bit of a high-low play, right? We're skipping the middle brow, right? We have high concept shit, and then we have a lot of fun, and don't worry about the middle brow because they're irrelevant.
Abandon the midwits.
Yeah,
spoken like somebody who's been hanging out with a rationalist for far too long, right? Like, if you're maybe I can find newsletter subscribers at the Ayla Orgy or whatever, it's like, okay, well, you've embedded
these people. If you go to, like, the Manifest Prediction Markets conference, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's actually a pretty small world, but yeah, it's all people who it is like an actual community that people neglect, right? There is, like, it's not intellectual dark web. It doesn't really overlap with that exactly, but there is, like, there are like-minded people out there. And I kind of guarantee you, if you're somebody, we're a very diverse country, right? If you're someone who's unhappy with your lot in life, there are so many wonderful sub-communities that would embrace you no matter what your kink is, I think, that you should pursue those. Don't waste your life being unhappy in boring, normal America.
Speaking of betting, you brought up betting markets there. That was the last question I would ask you here about probability and the subject of your book. By the way, we have gotten a couple live questions that we can throw in. If you're watching live, feel free to throw in right now, and we might be able to get to your question. But I wanted to ask, with regard to betting markets, like, how they've grown hugely in size. I mean, the And right now, the poly market is contradicting your forecasts, but not by much. It's got Donald Trump 50, yeah. At 50%, Kamala Harris at 49%, and she's been, you know, on the rise in the betting markets. How do you actually look at betting markets? How valuable are they as a predictor? And what should you be careful about when you're either participating in or trying to look to them for some sort of forecast?
And look, I should disclose, I am an advisor to Polymarket. I have equity in the company, and so therefore I have incentives to pump them up. Yes. I do think,
thank you for that.
With that disclaimer in mind, so discount whatever I say by 20%, I do think prediction markets have turned a corner now where you have enough volume. Like, I am, for the most part, a believer in efficient markets. Not perfectly so. I think kind of, if you read the first book, Signal the Noise, efficient markets are kind of a paradox. You need people who pursue gains in the market to make markets efficient. Because everything is so political now, financial firms understand that there's a lot of political risk involved in any type of trade that they might make. And so therefore there is more of an interest in pricing out economic risk and political risk, because it affects every portion of your business potentially. And so, look, the fact is that my model and Polymarket and Manifest, other places, are all pretty well aligned for the most part. And I'm a big believer that when you have skin in the game, to quote an author who's a bit of a rival of mine, but when you have skin in the game, are you willing to like actually put money on the line? That tends to be more credible. There often are no consequences for if you're in the village. You can write a newspaper column, go on Morning Joe or a podcast and say anything you want, and people will have short memories and forget it. If you're willing to like put money on the line, then all else being equal, I trust your answer more.
I think that's a really good insight. And I think about that so frequently with regard to, it feels like there's been a coming out of the closet among some of the Silicon Valley set lately, specifically with regard to Trump support, perhaps because the possible loss of social capital, it's just decreased, right? Like I think people just feel far more comfortable with that than ever before. And there's been this interesting thing that I keep running into, which is like, okay, even though it's becoming sometimes a little bit of a slightly like cultish embrace of Trump, and it's almost like a signal that you're part of this like in group within Silicon Valley at this point, there's also just this sense of like, I'm always interested in the rationale, because a lot of these people, like, I'm not interested in sort of discounting people who've made massive quantities of money and who have done a lot of real world stuff. I'm so much more interested in what they have to say and what their justification is versus the editorial board of God knows what publication, because to me, it at least just kind of seems like, well, you know, what's the way in which I can learn from your thinking, which isn't to say that they're gods or kings, but it is to say that like, I just find it to be a weird reflex of so much of the media to discount Silicon Valley as sort of like Trump loving dumb rich guys, when it's like, well, but that's just not true. I think that's just overly simplistic and you miss something at your own peril.
Look, the book has a lot about Silicon Valley. It includes interviews with, you know, some of the best VCs in the world. And it presents a portrait that I think is very mixed and ambivalent in certain ways.
It's complicated.
Yeah. They're complicated people and flawed people. I mean, look, in some ways, if you think the book is like a hagiography, I mean, the central character in some ways is Sam Bankman-Fried, and the book is not kind towards Sam or the people in his orbit who supported him. But at the same time, I mean, look, I think you're right, Liz. There's been like a permission structure that's been unlocked or something. It's also kind of, in some ways, classic economic self-interest where, yeah, you know, obviously, Lena Khan is anti-big tech and taxes are high in California and will be raised most likely by a Harris-Walz administration. If you read the backstory on Elon Musk's estrangement from the Democratic Party, it's partly culture war things, but also partly that, like, you know, the Biden White House wasn't very friendly to Tesla because they're not unionized and things like that. So it's economic self-interest, I think. And the culture war stuff plays into that a little bit, but you know, business elites have always sided with the Republican Party for the most part, and the kind of the Obama era, you know, kumbaya moment where you had big tech on the Democratic corner was in some ways more of the anomaly.
You've got to go soon, Nate. So we're going to wrap up in a minute, but cool. I do want to throw in just a couple questions from the audience. There's a couple interesting ones here. One is from Darla. Kashka. I just don't know if Republicans can win presidential elections anymore. I've heard that a lot for feels like two or three election cycles. Are we approaching that point in America where an electoral win's not even in the cards for Republicans?
I mean, look, it's 50-50 this time, right? So so I'd wait for this election to pan out, and then I'd wait for, you know, the first election. They've run Trump three times in a row, which is the first time, I think, since like William Jennings Bryan or something. The party's nominated the same candidate. I forget exactly. But like, we haven't really run the experiment without Trump, and they're gonna have a heck of a time navigating, I think, the post-Trump landscape. I mean, you had a lot of talented Republicans challenge him, and no one came particularly close this time. But no, I think that's making too much of small sample sizes, for better or worse.
One more from Sola Cliptura. What does Nate make of the argument that J.D. Vance was picked as an insurance policy on Trump's life? And I'll broaden that a little bit to an insurance policy against lawfare or impeachment, that sort of thing.
I mean, the best thing you could say about J.D. Vance is that he is a younger, maybe smarter version of MAGAism, whatever that represents to you. And if you kind of read the reporting, that's why he was picked, not for electoral gain, but for, hey, he's kind of like the spitting image of Trump. And so he increases the upside if Trump were to win. Now you have a logical successor. I think it wasn't a great pick. I mean, Ohio's not a swing state anymore. He has been unable to fend off this weird attack, I think. I think he spent like a little bit too much time in like the online street sprawling. Like, you wouldn't want to make me a vice presidential picker. Any of us in the podcast would make a terrible, we're way too online. All three of us are way too online. So please do not nominate any of us for vice president. But I think J.D. Vance was probably not the best pick in an election where, because of Harris succeeding Biden and because of, lest we forget, the assassination attempt against Donald Trump, people are thinking a lot about the VPs. And I think that's an edge. Even though I would have picked Josh Shapiro, I think that Tim Walz is a much more traditional choice and a better choice than J.D. Vance.
I'm going to lob the question at you that we ask all of our guests. Nate Silver, what's one question that you think more people should be asking?
I shouldn't be prepared for this, right? I think people should spend more time on like epistemics. Like, why do we think what we think? How do we know what we know? Because I think the epistemics are very flawed in a lot of ways in the country. We like default toward lazy ideas like labeling things as misinformation and not really kind of thinking very much about like, how are people persuaded? How does our perception of the truth emerge? If I had to write another book right now, it might be about that, I suppose. But by
I like to envision you just walking onto the Florida Casino Floor in 2020 being like, epistemics, man. Like,
yeah. No, it might not, probably won't sell as well as a book about degenerate gambling. But
I feel like
you
can
know.
Do it all, right? Like, yeah. Jack of all trades. Nate Silver, thank you so much for talking to Just Asking Questions.
Thank you so much, Liz. Thank you, Zach.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Just Asking Questions. These conversations appear on Reason's YouTube channel and the Just Asking Questions podcast feed every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and please rate and review the show.